American lady, she tells me, and I'm good. Welcome to the Gentleman Ultra podcast, where we're continuing our special World Cup series, three World Cup questions, where we ask the same three questions to some of our friends in the world of culture. Our guest today is Tom Underhill, the author of The Working Hands of a Goddess, The Tactics, Culture, and Community Behind Giampiero Gasparini's Atalanta. Tom, thanks for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me back on, Frank.
Oh, it was, my pleasure.
I loved our conversation in the summer. So, yeah, thank you very much for inviting me on.
Oh, no problems. And for those who haven't checked out Tom's book on Atalanta, it's 5 stars. Definitely, you're missing out. You're missing out. You need to get your hands on a copy. So, first question. What's your favorite moment from your World Cup past?
Well, as we were kind of saying off camera, so to speak, I feel like my choices of what my first World Cup are might make other people feel quite old. So I haven't been alive for too many World Cups. So I was born in 1999. So my first World Cup would have been Japan and South Korea 2002, but the first that I remember was 2006 and then 2010. And being English, my kind of experience of those World Cups were framed by what England were at that time, which was high celebrity but rubbish, and the tabloid culture of vilifying those incredibly talented players who couldn't pull it together at World Cups, and who were almost, they were kind of villains in the English narrative of what it meant to be World Cup favourites. Like 2006, that golden generation of Ashley Cole, Rio Ferdinand, John Terry, Beckham, Lampard, Gerrard, Rooney, Michael Owen, like that is that was an incredible group of players who, you know, on paper were one of the favorites to win that tournament, didn't, and they failed spectacularly. And that kind of your experience of that team and of that World Cup becomes framed by those failures and by the kind of the toxic negativity that comes through that. And I actually think that's probably what pushed me into enjoying football from other countries and other leagues, and why I feel so attached to Serie A and like watching the Bundesliga and like watching other international teams aside from England. So this kind of brings me on to my favorite kind of match memory from the World Cup was at that 2006 World Cup in Germany, and it was the quarterfinal between France and Brazil. And I had a Brazil shirt, and being 7 years old, I can't remember exactly, but I would have undoubtedly wanted Brazil to win, because that was the Brazil of Ronaldinho and Adriano, Ronaldo, just a Kaká. Like, it was just the unbelievable team who just epitomized the joy of what it means to enjoy football at the age of seven. Like, doesn't, you know, that was the team I undoubtedly would have leaned towards. And, you know, they, even just kind of visually what those players look like, as well as my own experience of being English and watching the Premier League, would have kind of created what it meant in my eyes to be an amazing footballer. So there would have been like a stylish element to it, or either young and stylish, basically, or both. You know, sort of in the England camp, you'd have had Rooney and Owen and Theo Walcott and the kind of the exuberance of youth. Not so much Michael Owen in that case, maybe, but then with Brazil, it was like the style and, you know, Kaká, Ronaldinho, and then even in the France team, Thierry Henry, just visibly what it meant to identify what a good player was. It certainly wasn't a bold, grizzled man in his 30s playing central midfield for France. And yet what Zinedine Zidane did that day was like, it was mesmeric. And you go through Twitter every few months, and it's quite hard to not like bump into a montage from that match where he's kind of doing pirouettes in the middle of the pitch, and he's doing keepy ups over Gilberto Silva's head. And I kind of describe it, it was like he was playing Joga Bonito football against Brazil. Like, that is That is just amazing. That and
so is that your favorite moment and your favorite match?
It's my favorite match. It was very. I could have easily put it as my moment as well. Like it was just a that team, like that Brazil team got schooled by Zidane in his twilight years. Like, and I think it would have been quite confusing for a 7-year-old to see this kind of stony faced, grizzled guy, like broad chested, play with such a kind of light touch and just be that amazing, particularly when you've got players like Ronaldinho on the pitch. And yeah, he was just amazing. And the fact that whole World Cup becomes, you look at that World Cup almost entirely through the prism of Zidane's career, in the sense of like that was his final tournament. He played his last match in the final, where he obviously famously got sent off for headbutting Marco Materazzi, but in the 7th minute scored a Panenka penalty in a World Cup final that bounced in off the crossbar, and kind of just shrugged his shoulders when it went in. Like, it was the most nonchalant, across the whole tournament, the most nonchalant display of a guy's greatness. And the fact he just disappeared thereafter, he in that final against Italy, he performs the most ridiculous act anyone's ever seen in a World Cup final. Walks off down the tunnel past the World Cup trophy and is never seen in a playing kit ever again. Mm. Obviously, he comes back to manage, but very different to what Zidane meant as a player. And
that photo too of him walking past the trophy, it's like an iconic picture, isn't it?
It's kind of heartbreaking. Like, I guess not for if you're of an Italian persuasion where you watch that final as an Italian fan, I imagine it was the best thing you could have seen was to see him in that form be sent off. But when you think about what, you know, there's a generation of people who, when you say Zidane, they just think of him headbutting someone.
Headbutt.
And not, yeah. And he was so much more than that. And yeah, that quarterfinal against Brazil, and he set up the goal for Henri to score. And I read some, I think it was in Michael Cox's book, Zonal Marking, where I think he said that they played over 100 caps together, Zidane and Thierry Henry, and yet they only combined for 2 goals ever. And that was one of them.
Yeah.
And
the other one was the other one the handball against Ireland?
Oh, I mean, see what? I think that would have been the most Zidane goal ever. I think
I'm only joking. I kid.
Yeah. Yeah. It would have been. If you think about
it's funny because, like you mentioned there, how you always see those montages of him on Twitter. But yeah. I mean, if you go on YouTube and there's countless, you know, montages of Zidane being compared to like a ballerina and a dancer and, you know, Zidane dancing, you know, like you put those two words in and you'll find, you know, an endless stream of videos of him just, you know, dancing his way throughout the final. I know Cannavaro complained about it when they always playing against him, how he felt like he was, you know, he was so, like you said, just so light-footed, if that's a word. But just so delicate in everything he did, but so clinical at the same time.
Yeah, he was just that whole tournament where France weren't. They weren't a dominant team. In the same way that Italy obviously went on to win the World Cup, they weren't a particularly dominant team either. But and really, no one in that whole tournament was. All the big sides in that tournament, maybe with the exception of Germany, were had big flaws and didn't have that. Looking back, it would have been quite hard to identify who that winner would have been up until maybe about the semi-final stage. There was no outright outstanding team. They were just good teams that featured outstanding players.
Yeah.
And that almost kind of epitomizes Zidane's legacy in his career, in the sense of that he, in a kind of data and statistical sense, you look back and you're, to someone who's never seen him play, they would have been quite confused as to what the fuss is, really, because statistically he is a bit of an anomaly. But yeah, and it's just the contrast, really. But light-footed and deft and just a stunning can't even really say an athlete, just a, like a performer to watch. And yet he was kind of grizzled and stony faced and playing with a real chip on his shoulder. And then also there's the, it's the fact of playing against Brazil, like Zidane's greatest moment had been the World Cup final of 98, where he'd scored those two headers against Brazil. And it was almost like a, it was like a kind of 8 years later, like an almost like an evolution of Zidane, where he just become this huge, like an enigma, playing against the most enigmatic team of all time. And it was just, it was, yeah. And I think that was I remember it, and yeah, it was just a, yeah. If that team and that World Cup will always probably be my favorite World Cup because of how I felt being 7 years old and watching it.
I wonder if many of those, like, because if you're looking at the team, like I'm looking at the team lineups now, because obviously I don't know your selections beforehand. You haven't told me, but I'm looking at the team lineups now, and I wonder if a lot of those guys, like, essentially, it's almost like a rematch of the 98 final.
Yeah.
Both of those teams were there in 98.
Yeah, and in fact, well, we can probably segue in because I've chosen them as my team. I've chosen them as my favorite World Cup team.
France 2006. I've gone for
2006 France. There are a few reasons for it, and it could easily have been that Italian team from 2006 as well. But different reasons, but just yeah, I suppose they were the first. That would have been the first like winning World Cup side I would have ever seen. And some of those players were, like, to this day remain some of my most favorite players and ones that I wish I could have experienced at an older age. So Alessandro Nesta, Andrea Pirlo. I mean, luckily we saw Pirlo for a long time after that World Cup, but Totti as well. Yeah, three of my favorite players ever. But that France team. And it was the mix of, like you say, it was like a real coming together of generations, whereby that 98 team had reached its, that was its final crescendo, because they in 2010 they brought some of those same guys remained in 2010, but that tournament crashed and burned because France did what France do, where they just absolutely implode. And so that 2006 was like the final. It was like the final crescendo of the Henri, Zidane, Wiltord, Vieira, Makélélé, Lilian Thuram. That team. That was its final crescendo. And they had that balance between being great, but also having the kind of the madness and the some of the action that you can't really comprehend that should be in a France team. Like, you know, the obvious one is the Zidane, you know, Zidane doing that in a World Cup final is just, you kind of, it's so ingrained in his career and how we remember him that we kind of forget just how mental a thing that was to do. Like, to headbutt someone in a World Cup final when your side, you know, it's 1-1, then you're in with a shout of winning your second World Cup, and yeah,
you scored the penalty to take them into the league.
Scored the penalty, and not just the penalty, like a Panenka penalty in a World Cup final that just bounced in off the crossbar, and they went on to lose that World Cup final on penalties, and you do wonder whether, I mean, you wonder whether he could have really had that. You know, having him as a penalty taker could have at least taken it to another round. And David Trezeguet missed the penalty, but funny enough, thumping it against the crossbar, whereas Zidane had just clipped it to let it bounce in.
Karma. Definitely not karma for Euro 2000 for Trezeguet. Definitely.
Oh yeah, no, definitely not. No, nothing. No, there's definitely no greater force at, you know, at play.
I'm just looking at that team now, and Pascal Chimbonda was on the team. I never knew that.
Oh yeah, and that's kind of what I mean. It's like it's a coming together of like generations, and also of, you had these elite doesn't even begin to cover it, but like the cream of the crop elite players in Thierry Henry, Zidane,
Jean-Alain Boumsong. There's a stack of Serie A players on the French side,
yeah,
the Italian team, but
Exactly. Yeah. And then equally at the other end, you had the players that were like the facilitators, the water carriers that were like, I mean, I don't think Chimbonda did Chimbonda. I'm not sure Chimbonda actually played during
No,
the
I don't think he
tournament.
played. Yeah, it
I
was
think we're
Diarra, Trezeguet, and Wiltord came on off the bench.
yeah.
But
Yeah, I
Lilian
mean
Thuram was there. Like, he was.
exactly. And Trezeguet being a Juventus, being at Juventus for so many years, and Lilian Thuram's an interesting one as well, because he watching back that final, as I have done recently, he you could tell that he was kind of at the end of his he was he'd kind of reached his he'd reached he'd gone past his peak, and but where my it kind of the way that these things work and go full circle. My first the first ever interview I ever did as a writer was with the director of the academy that Lilian Thuram's son Marcus played for when he was 10 years old. Now Marcus Thuram is obviously now he plays for Borussia Mönchengladbach, having a brilliant season, and has been called up as a late entry to the French squad. He's kind of forging his own career away from just being Lilian Thuram's son. And I wrote an article about him and his development, and I interviewed the director of the academy that he'd come through. This is the first ever interview I'd ever done, and the person I spoke to said that he Marcus Thuram turned up to training once as a 10-year-old boy wearing boots that Lilian Thuram had worn in the World Cup semi-final in 2006. Which is, I mean, yeah, like I said, it went it was it really kind of I remember phoning my dad afterwards just to tell him, because I was just so chuffed that I'd got this interview. But all I was thinking about was watching that France team and watching Lilian Thuram in my first World Cup. And yet my first interview I'd conducted was with like someone close to his son, and this kind of this story about him wearing his boots from a match that I had watched. And it was just and the other funny side of it, of course, is that a 10-year-old Marcus Thuram could fit in his dad's boots, because Marcus Thuram is 6'3" and an unbelievable physical specimen who is just a brilliant prospect, and he's such a good player to watch, and hopefully get some well minutes of this World Cup. But yeah, that kind of all those kind of things kind of combined together to just make me remember that France team with like huge fondness, and yeah, probably set me on a course to World Cup fandom forever.
Yeah, Marcus could have played for Italy. Is that right? Is he eligible because he was born in Parma?
He could have done. Yeah, and there've been links with Italy for a while in terms of Inter were very interested in him when it looked like Lautaro might leave over the summer. When Tottenham put in a bid for him, they were looking at Marcus Thuram as being a kind of cheap alternative player, very different player to Lautaro, but he was very heavily linked, and he still is being, because he's having a brilliant season with he had a very bad season last year because Mönchengladbach were relegation threatened at one point,
That's
and
probably why
suffered.
Inter was trying to get in, because I thought we could sneak in
Exactly.
and get him on the cheap.
Exactly. Yeah, strike while the iron's cold, I guess. But he's been linked again this year because he's absolutely flying in the Bundesliga. But then he also the I know that Atalanta were interested in him when he was the before he went to Mönchengladbach. Atalanta were interested, I believe, because one of the general directors spoke in the week saying how they'd inquired about bringing him to Bergamo. So there've always been links with him to Italy, like you say, like the Parma connection, and Lilian Thuram being playing for Juventus as well. And
It's funny that, because he played for Parma for 5 years, and then he played for Juventus for 5 years. But if you say Lilian Thuram to me, like, I think of him in Parma. I don't think of him in Turin at all. Like, I've just
See,
blocked that out completely.
that's interesting. That might be a because I associate with him with being Juventus, and then obviously latterly Barcelona, because that's where he kind of played a couple years at the end of his career. And yeah, that's like my own memory of him, and well, probably chiefly being a France player, like playing in that white away kit, in that final against the blue of Italy. That's how I remember him, and yeah, just a lovely, lovely memory all around.
Before I ask you what your favorite moment of your World Cup journey is, what do you think if Zidane had won the World Cup twice, what do you think that would have done to his already stellar legacy? Would have that put him in the conversation of, you know, the Maradonas and Pelés and Messis of the world? Or do you think he's already there?
I think he is probably will be remembered as the bracket beneath that. And that's probably fair. I think that is probably fair because these players, when you're talking about the absolute best to ever kick a ball, you're not just talking about the ability, you are talking about this, the statistical and the output to an extent. And frankly, when you are comparing Messi and Maradona to Zidane, there is a disjunct. And that could be just because they play different positions. There's going to be a disjunct.
Different
there.
Positions, different era, different game.
Exactly.
But just the sheer fact of he won two World Cups.
Oh, I think that would, I mean, it would only further it. And but then equally, you wonder, because he was always going to retire after that World Cup. So him finishing on that note would have been like, it would have been the perfect ending. But in a way, for a career like that and a player like him, is the perfect ending not that he went up in this huge, what's the word, kind of dramatic, like, moment? If anything, it suits the temperament and the enigma that is Zinedine Zidane. The only thing that slightly belies is the fact he went into management. Really, if he disappeared and never ever was seen to do a football again, that would have been the puff of smoke kind of element to it. But
and it wasn't like he was a clean skin. I mean, he got a few red cards in his career as well.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, he always had that. He always had that in his game. And he's just a fascinating character. And you can't help but be kind of be interested in the myth, and the myth of Zidane only becomes whole by him doing that and him losing that World Cup final, which is kind of interesting when you think about it, because you know how we'd view him differently if he had won it. And he hadn't, you know, even if he hadn't won it, if he just hadn't been sent off in the final, like, how would we view him today? How would future generations view him, you know? But yeah, I guess we'll never know.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite moment from the World Cup past, or is all of those answers rolled into one? That is the favorite moment.
Well, I'm gonna roll forward 8 years, and again, probably more recent than a lot of the other guests that you'll have on in a series of like a moment, because this is at the Brazil World Cup in 2014, so I'd been 15 at that time, and this is linked solely to a player rather than the team, and I've been 15 at the time in my final year of secondary school, and that Brazil World Cup was probably the most like holistic to watch, in the sense of it was a great tournament for a start, like really good high goal count. It was held in Brazil, so visually to look at, to watch it being broadcast with a pundit's table on a beach and the kind of festival type atmosphere surrounding that World Cup. That was like and also being 15 and being at school and being able to talk to people at school, you know, kind of sharing in a World Cup together, that's like a very different experience to when you're younger, or even when you're a bit older. I felt like that's a really important part, particularly in this country. That's a really important part of experiencing a World Cup. This was also the time where the first World Cup, really, where the Cristiano Ronaldo versus Lionel Messi debate had hit kind of supersonic levels, with both at the forefront of teams that were not in the favorites category but were probably in the tier beneath it, in the sense they both had a lot of talent, but there was like gaping holes in both Portugal's and Argentina's team. You look at that Argentina squad their forward line was Gonzalo Higuain, Lionel Messi, Angel Di Maria, Sergio Aguero, and then Ezequiel Lavezzi. Like, that's mad. That's a hell of a... But then you go back towards the rest of the team, and you've got, you know, you've got their exceptions. You've got, you know, Javier Mascherano's in there. But Pablo Zabaleta's at right back. But really...
Fernando Gago was there, number five.
Fernando Gago, of course.
Love him.
Yeah, like... Yeah, and there were, but there was a lot of that team was built around not getting beaten by not letting their flaws, as in the rest of the squad not being as good as their attacking kind of lineup, not letting that overshadow the kind of, it was basically get the ball to the forwards and let them do what they had to do. And generally in World Cups, if you go back through successful World Cup teams, that is generally a recipe for disaster in the sense of if the team's impetus is placed entirely on a genuinely brilliant few, then that falls apart when those teams get crowded out and those players get denied the space and the freedom to do what they have to do. And so this, it's not the most fashionable match this moment that I'm recalling, but it was they're playing against Iran in the group stages. And Iran had held them to it was 0-0 in the 90th minute, and just a perfect show of defiance and resilience against bit of a superpower team. And Messi gets the ball on the right wing, 90th minute, so it's almost Hail Mary time. And Jonathan Pearce, who was on the BBC commentary, said a line that I will just remember forever. So Messi's got the ball on the right wing, he takes a touch, and Jonathan Pearce says, "Give it to Messi and pray." And before he even pulled the trigger to shoot, I remember just thinking, like, this is, he's going to score here. He's going to score. And this is, of course, when you're, you know, La Liga, and the only experience you get of watching, you had of watching Messi at the time was Champions League matches, shown on, at the time, were on free-to-air terrestrial British TV, but couldn't have watched the week in, week out Barcelona stuff. So really, the cult of Messi was built off what you'd heard, what he was doing, rather than what you were seeing. But yeah, so it, and this moment kind of cemented what he meant to me. And yeah, got the ball on the right wing, give it to Messi and pray, and he curled it into the far corner. And it was only against, like, with all due respect, it was only against Iran. Like, it wasn't in a World Cup semi-final, it wasn't in a World Cup final. It was just a group stage match against Iran that Argentina should have won. And even though they did win it 1-0, should have been disappointed that it took for Messi to do that to win it. Like, they should have. But there was something about that moment that just started something. And it's almost unfashionable to say, because obviously Messi makes you feel stuff. He's one of the greatest players ever. Like, it's like if someone said, "Oh, Maradona made me fall in love with football." It's like it's an obvious statement. Like, there's nothing niche about it. It's like, well, of course he did. But Messi is a player who makes me feel physically, like, emotional when I watch him.
And he had a relatively great World Cup. Like, he was scoring. He scored every goal, every game in the group stage. He scored the winner in the first game against Bosnia.
Herzegovina.
He scored the winner against Iran. He scored two in the 3-2 win against Nigeria. But to give that game context too, Iran had a nil-all draw against Nigeria in their first group match.
Yeah.
So if they had managed to pull out 2 points out of a possible six against Nigeria and Argentina, and then they've got to play Bosnia and Herzegovina in the final game, they're in with a shout to get through to the group stage and possibly send Argentina, Argentina home, or send Nigeria home. So, Iran didn't do themselves, like, they definitely weren't disgraced, or it wasn't like, you know, they were there just as the whipping boys.
No, and it makes it feel quite mean in a way. To include my favourite moment as being, in my opinion, the greatest player of all time, scoring a goal against Iran to basically knock them out of the World Cup. That feels really like a punching down, like, moment. But it was enough. It was just the context of seeing him do that. And it can almost be unfashionable. Like I said, it can almost be unfashionable to say that Lionel Messi makes you feel a certain way because it's so obvious. But he does. He kind of... I've been in, like, with so many other people, just been in love with watching him and what he stands for. And, like, I got, like, it, thinking about that goal gives me goosebumps, and thinking about him gives me goosebumps. And as well, you think about that time as us, that was 2014. So that was 2 years after the end of the Guardiola kind of era at Barcelona, where they, you know, Messi was at the absolute, like, hit some heights that football had never ever seen hit, like, you know, hitting 90 goals in a calendar year, that sort of thing, like, just mind-boggling levels of not just goal scoring. Until Gasperini
come along.
Messi under Gasperini. That would actually, no, we've seen it. His name's Papu Gomez. But...
yeah. Just don't say anything to Conor Clancy about it.
No, absolutely not. Yeah. No,
Papu's there now with him, so you never know what can happen.
That's the thing. You've got the two greatest players of all time on the same squad, so surely they're gonna Argentina they can gonna
conjure
win
up some magic.
Yeah, just from different sides of the pitch. Yeah. Yeah. And that time, so 2014 was, you're looking at, he'd been building towards that moment. So Barcelona had won two Champions League finals in 3 years against Manchester United. One was at Rome, one was at Wembley, and it was building towards this moment in Brazil at the Maracanã. And it seemed like he was destined to do it, because he was dragging them through these games. Argentina were not a great team that tournament at all. And those games against, like, against Bosnia and Herzegovina, and then against Nigeria, they weren't comfortable. They weren't comfortable wins, if I remember correctly. And Messi scored a free kick against Nigeria. He's just dragging them through the tournament, and he gets to the final against a very strong Germany team. And Higuain does what Higuain does in finals and misses a one-on-one chance. And
I may have had a few jelly beans on Argentina to win that World Cup.
Yeah.
I wasn't very happy.
I hate that. I would have been too young to participate in that Frank at the time, but I would have done as well if I could.
Yeah. I had Messi for top scorer in Argentina to win the World Cup. And I think James Rodriguez finished top scorer, I think by one goal, I think it was.
Yeah. And yeah, one or two, wasn't it?
Obviously,
yeah.
The final is the final, but. It all adds to the legacy of it, and that's what makes all of these memories so individual and so special, that you can find, like, if you'd asked me to try and pick five moments that I potentially thought you would have picked, I would have never ever picked that. So
yeah
hats off to you. You've knocked it out of the park.
What can I say? I was trying to buck the trend and go for I mean, I couldn't pick England, so
that's right.
Yeah.
All right, Tom, thanks for your time. That was awesome. Much appreciated. It's been great
to
chat. Thank
you so much, my friend. Thank you very much. And yeah, look forward to listening to it back.
There you go. It was a great conversation with Tom Underhill, the author of The Working Hands of a Goddess. That's a fantastic book on Atalanta. And yeah, another great conversation on our World Cup series. It's incredible. The varied selection and choices that all of the guests are coming up with. Don't forget, you can find more Calcio goodness at gentlemanultra.com. And thanks for listening. Don't forget to rate, review, and share the podcast where you can. It's all very much appreciated. Enjoy your Calcio.